And what I want to say to you is, hi, my name is Sarah, and I'm a grammar grouch. Seriously. When I was a child, I would mutter language corrections under my breath, not just to my so-called peers, none of whom spoke as well as I, but even to grown-ups. Henry Higgins was my hero. Anyone betraying a heavy regional accent immediately got filed under contempt, and I grew up in the Dallas area. I had a lot of contempt going on. When I started training as a performer as a teenager, my teacher was determined to kill off our native drawls. Over and over, we would intone this. I love my truck. I love my truck so much. I love to sit in my truck and pet my dog and drink my cold beer in the truck I love so much. And then he'd make us follow it up with this. Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene. From ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. The sad part is, it worked. Most people who meet me now are astounded that I'm from Texas. And when I was living in New York during the Bush years, that suited me fine, I admit. And then I read Robert Lane Greene's You Are What You Speak. For the first time, I was able to understand the inclusive richness of the English language, an inclusiveness broad enough even for I love my truck. When relatives tell me that Jimmy and myself was wondering where my hammer was at, I still, but I keep it to myself better. And sometimes I listen to some Buddy Holly, and my much-abused drawl creeps out of hiding just a little bit, and it's okay. The intersection of language and politics is no surprise for Robert Lane Greene, an international correspondent for The Economist and a frequent commentator on international affairs, who speaks a whopping 9 languages. He has also written for The New Republic, The New York Times, and Slate. He serves as assistant adjunct professor at NYU and term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. I believe this is his first book, and given its impact, I can't wait to see how the next one will change lives. Please join me in welcoming Robert Lane Greene.
Thank you so much, Sarah. From Texas to New York, where, of course, there is no accent. I want to thank the New York Society Library for having me. This is my first time here, I'll admit, and it's a wonderful venue. I'm really proud to be standing up here and speaking to you all about this book and about how I came to write it. Normally when I give a talk, I sort of take one of the subjects and go on at length, but this being a library, I thought I'd actually talk about the story of the book a little bit in personal terms and then go through a little bit of what I talk about. There is material here that's not in the book so that if you read it later, you won't have heard the whole thing and you will have gotten some benefit from being here that you will have some benefit from both being here and reading the book. There's material in the book, obviously, that I'm not going to be able to cram into 45 minutes, and then there's a lot more that I want to go on about today. So a lot of people ask me, when you write a book, the sort of standard public radio question to the guest is, well, you know, how did you come to write this book? There are a couple answers to that. One is that I'm a correspondent of The Economist, so I write about politics, and I studied political science, and then I came to language, so I put politics and language together and came to write this book, my two academic intellectual interests. But there's a sort of more interesting story about my personal introduction to language and the way I came to think about it. My first real introduction to it was when I first started thinking about language as a young adult, or young, really a boy, was through my grandfather. And my grandfather lived in Texas. He retired to San Antonio. So every summer, my family, my mother is here in attendance, would send me and my brother off to San Antonio, spend a few weeks with my grandmother and my grandfather in San Antonio. We loved those summers. And my grandfather, in particular, was an archetypal language nerd. He loved the language. He loved grammar. He loved vocabulary. He loved articulation. If anything, he said to me over and over again, it was, Lane, speak slowly and enunciate. That was his mantra, speak slowly and enunciate. I try to do that when I get up here and speak about language, but I get so excited I speed up a little bit. You're going to have to forgive me a little bit for that. It's just the way I am. I hope to at least enunciate if I don't speak slowly. But Grandpa was the kind of person who had these books on his shelves, lots of dictionaries, lots of grammars. If he were alive today, he probably would have gotten a copy of Lynn Truss's Eat, Shoots, and Leaves, that book there on the right, which is about the correct use of punctuation and why people who misuse punctuation should be hacked to pieces and buried in a shallow grave. That is a direct quote, and I'll come back to Lynn Truss in this context. So when I was hanging out at my grandfather's house, he would play a game with me and my brother. This is the kind of grandfather he was. We had a game called the locomotion game. And he said, all right, Hank, that's my brother, I want you to sidle across the room. My brother would think about what a sidle meant and do his best. And then he said, Lane, I want you to mosey across the room. Mosey. And he would say, okay, Hank, I want you to amble across the room. And Lane, I want you to strut and so on through all these wonderful words. Go wasn't good enough for Grandpa. I thought, some of these words I'd only ever read. I don't know if you sidle sideways. What exactly does it mean to sidle? It made me put physical sensations to these wonderful words. He liked to teach us these big fancy words. He said, why not say just a lot of something? A plethora is a word that he liked to use. We have a plethora of this or a plethora of that. If you had just a little bit of something, he said, you have a paucity of it. And so I always remember the pair of a plethora and a paucity. And so the way I started thinking about language was, language is using big fancy words like plethora and sidle correctly. It was using grammar correctly. If I said, me and Hank are going to run to the store, he said, who's going to the store? In his very slow baritone, he was a colonel in the army and he had a command voice to beat the band. He said, who's going to the store? And I said, Hank and I are going to the store. And only then were we allowed to leave. So this was my first encounter with thinking about language consciously. And it was the story of many a grammar grouch and stickler who came to appreciate the correct use of these fancy $100 words and the proper application of grammar. When I got to college, in high school and college, I started learning foreign languages, and as was mentioned, I'm a real foreign language nerd, too. I found them easy to learn. I found them enjoyable. Unlike most kids who encounter their first foreign language at 14, I just couldn't get enough of Spanish. Started German in college, and then French, and then Portuguese, and it just started a ball rolling downhill, but never really stopped. And so I extended this fancy-pants thinking about language to all these foreign languages that I was learning. I was so proud to know the proper rules of the German subjunctive or the Spanish past perfect or, some of these niceties of the foreign languages I learned. And I added that on to this fabulous, elaborate scaffolding I had in my mind, which was correct language. But there is another way to think about language, and it starts with this guy right here. My father, and unfortunately don't have any recordings of my father, Wayne Green. He passed away just a couple of years ago, and I'm one of the great regrets I have is not having a good recording of his voice. We might find one in the archives one day, but I don't have one that I know of. So to illustrate my dad, I just have this this clip right here. Okay, this is a laser pointer. Let me see if I can... Dad reminds me of Foghorn Leghorn. So the story I tell in my book, which doesn't have an audio clip in any case, was this one, where I came home to my dorm room. I went off to Oxford for graduate school and spent 2 years at the University of Oxford, as fancy in English as you're going to find. I met a girlfriend from New Zealand, and I brought her home early in our relationship and saw the light blinking on my answering machine, so I pressed the button. And this is what I heard. Boy, what the hell are you doing? This is your dad calling to check up on you, but I guess you're out in one of them bars. Give me a call back when you get a chance. So that was what I heard, and I was actually taken aback a bit. I thought, God, my dad doesn't normally talk that way, does he? And I sort of half apologized to my roommate, or I'm sure my friend. I said, he doesn't really normally have that kind of southern accent, but I wasn't sure. So I called my mother, and I said, Mom, has dad's southern accent gotten a lot stronger recently? She said, no, I don't think so. So my father was raised in Macon, Georgia, right in the center of the state. And he was Macon, Georgia distilled. He had the accent. He had the clever, funny turns of phrase. He had the storyteller's gift. The fish got bigger. The other guy in the fight got bigger every time he told those stories. He used to say, the street I lived on where he grew up, the further you went down the street, the meaner the kids got. And I lived in the last house on the left. So that was... a very different English that I grew up with. I talked about my encounter with my grandfather before this encounter in Oxford, where I listened to my dad on my answering machine, not having heard his voice very often in those days. All of a sudden, it was a new experience. It hit me fresh in a way that it never had before. My father became like this foreign language speaker to me, a guy who had this mysterious or exotic dialect that I was just discovering for the first time at age 23. And so at that point in my life, I started to realize I'm kind of half Southern. This is part of me, just like the sort of command diction and the very standard English of my grandfather on the other side was English too. I started to realize there was a lot more to English than just big words, correct grammar, and Henry Higgins' accent. So I started writing this book years later when I found that the interest of politics and language came together in a neat package that I didn't see anyone else writing in a book. And one of the things that I noted in my early reading about language is just the extent to which mythology is built up around language. And in our most sacred and earliest myths, we have stories from the Bible, from the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament and the Quran and others. All of our sacred texts have fundamentally linguistic aspects. Many of you know, we probably all know the story of the Tower of Babel, that the people, the Israelites, got together and started building a tower, and they said that if this tower will reach up to heaven and nothing can stop us, we will be as great as God. Now, God has infinite power. He can rain frogs, he can turn the rivers to blood, he can do whatever he wants. And yet he's so intimidated by the possibility of unity through language that he destroys the tower and confounds the languages of the Israelites. And so goes the biblical story. We got all of the world's languages, an early myth that tells us of our fascination with the subject of language. Another subject I couldn't find a good illustration for is the story of the word shibboleth. I don't know how many of you know this story, where that word comes from. But it was a time of warring tribes among the Israelites, and one tribe was trying to sneak across the River Jordan to attack the other. And so the guardians of the one tribe, it was the Gileadites and the Ephraimites, the guardians of the River Jordan made those trying to sneak across say the word shibboleth. And those who could not pronounce it correctly, who were of the enemy tribe, could not do it. They didn't have the sh sound in their dialect, and so they said sibboleth. And so the Gileadites knew that those were enemies, those were outsiders, and so they killed them on the spot. And so the book of Judges tells us 42,000 were slain at the fords of the Jordan. So this is the first story I know of language differences getting heated and even very violent. The Quran, the Islamic holy book, is up here because the Muslims of the world have a very special relationship to the language of the Quran, the Arabic language. They believe as a matter of religion, not just as a matter of practicality, that the Quran is literally untranslatable, that it is a sacrilege to take the Arabic of the Quran and use it for religious instruction in another language. At best, you can translate it as a bit of a teaching aid, but observant Muslims must read, must pray the Quran and its verses in the Arabic language. So our connection to our languages goes very deep to the things we hold dearest, including our religions. And so I realized this was a very emotional, a very powerful topic for people. And so the real question of the book became, why do people care so much about language? Where does this fascination and often anxiety and fear and frustration come from? So in a groundling chapter in the book I call The Brief History of Sticklers, I look at thousands of years of history of people showing their anxiety, that frustration about the way language is used. The earliest citation I use in the book is from Cicero, the Latin Roman statesman, who said, "For it is not so much noble to know Latin as it is disgraceful not to know it." So if you think that the language going down the tubes is something that is new, it's 2012 kind of issue, we have 2,000 years of history at the very least of Cicero complaining that nobody around him on the street spoke Latin. I'm not sure what the Latin for truck is, but he would have frowned on people pronouncing it incorrectly. This next citation is now exactly 300 years old. It's the Irish bishop and writer Jonathan Swift, who is writing in 1712 in a letter to the Earl of Oxford. "Our language is extremely imperfect, that its daily improvements are by no means in proportion to its daily corruptions, and the pretenders to polish and refine it have chiefly multiplied abuses and absurdities, and that in many instances it offends against every part of grammar." So if you think English just started going down the tube starting in the 1970s, this too, in our own language, has a very long and distinguished pedigree. Jonathan Swift was the grammar grouch, the stickler of his day. He was writing the Earl of Oxford, asking the Earl of Oxford to set up what he called an English Academy, a body of eminent scholars and writers in the English language who would fix and refine the language so that these corruptions and absurdities would be forbidden, shamed out of the language, and it would be fixed for future generations so it wouldn't fall to pieces. And finally, last but not least here on my slide is Lynn Truss. This is a direct quote from the book where she says, "People who misuse apostrophes should be hacked up on the spot and buried in a shallow grave." This book about punctuation, about apostrophes and commas, sold millions of copies, millions, to people who believe, I think like Lynn Truss does, that once everybody kind of knew how to use the language properly, but in recent decades, in the 60s, and student radicals, and liberalism, and the lowering of standards, and slouching towards Gomorrah, and all these things that we've heard so much about, had ruined even people's willingness to learn their own language properly, and if we didn't stop the rot, we'd soon all be basically babbling with each other like monkeys. So, Lynn Truss uses a lot of time-bound phrases to make it sound like this is a new phenomenon, but I show in that chapter that this is, in fact, a very old one. Usually the doomsayers always pick out the same culprit. Who is the culprit? It's kids today. It's the youth. It's the fashionable people who coin new words, who don't know how to use the old words correctly, who use pronunciations that are new, don't pronounce the old words correctly. And so Swift said, "I'd rather have trusted the refinement of our language as far as it relates to sound to the judgment of the women than of the illiterate court fops, half-witted poets, and university boys." So here we have the culprits, not just the university boys, the youth, the kids today in 1712, but the court fops today. We might think of journalists and hangers-on around the quarters of power who don't master the language and who spread their barbarisms through television on Fox News and MSNBC. The half-witted poets, so the guardians of our culture who should be writing in a perfect English but instead are corrupting it. In fact, Swift was particularly annoyed by the sound change that is now universal, the ED ending on most verbs in English, like played. At the time he was writing, English was in a transition where that syllable was usually pronounced. You would say play it and speak it and such like that. And it was marked, it's often marked in modern manuscripts with that sort of that accent mark when it's supposed to be pronounced. But Shakespeare, even 100 years earlier than Swift, had already started to put an apostrophe D in there when he wanted that sound to be just a sort of D sound, like played. This was still ongoing at Swift's time, but he thought it was just the decline and fall of civilization. Here we are 300 years later, that sound change has completely filtered through the language. The old Shakespearean ending that was pronounced fully is now one for history. So moving on from sound to grammar, we have a question when we talk about language, which is when we talk about correct English, and I do believe that there is a thing called standard correct English, there's a question, which is who makes these rules? I referred earlier to an institution, the French Academy, which is an official body of 40 French intellectuals, writers, and scholars, whose job it is officially to say what is correct French and what is not. And in theory, their rules are binding on the French language, so they have the final say. But there is no English Language Academy. That's why Swift was writing to the Earl of Oxford. He wanted one to be set up, but he was unsuccessful in that plea, and 300 years later, we still don't have any academy that tells you what are the rules, what is correct English, and what is not. So what that's given us instead is a lot of independent rulebook writers, people who take it upon themselves to examine the language, their own reading, the history of literature, the scholarly usages of their day, and sit down and write a grammar book and sort of derive the rules of the language and say, this is correct, this is not. And one of the first and fantastically successful one of these usage book, grammar book writers was a bishop in the English church, the Anglican church, named Robert Loth. He was the bishop of Oxford and then of London and would have become Archbishop of Canterbury had he not died in time. And so he was not only a bishop, not only a clergyman, but he was a grammarian. And he wrote a book called A Short Introduction to English Grammar, which was vastly influential. He was the Lynn Truss of his day. His book sold enormous amounts of copies, and those people who bought that book then went on to write grammar books in turn. So his influence on what we know of as the rules of English grammar have been very lasting. And he gave us this rule. He put it very clearly. Don't end a sentence in a preposition. He didn't put it in exactly those words, but he said, don't put this preposition at the end of their sentence because it is an idiom that our language is strongly inclined to. Those were his words. but it should be avoided in the best and clearest writing. So in his own words, violated the rule. We're not sure if he did so as a joke. He's not a funny guy, so he's not somebody we would have expected that from. But in laying down the rule, he violated it. And in fact, he wasn't the first to say it. The essayist and poet Dryden, John Dryden, about 100 years earlier, had also formulated a variety of this rule. Dryden was an essayist, Loth was a grammarian, so it was really Loth that put it in the books and made it so that every proper English speaker knew that this was not something that you're supposed to do. About half a century later, we have an anonymous writer who wrote just under the name of P, who we know, as far as we know, is the first writer to put down in print the injunction that you should not split an infinitive. That in a infinitive phrase like to go, nothing should go between the to and the go. So the Star Trek introduction should not read to boldly go where no man has gone before. And a third example in my brief history of sticklers is Strunk and White, the famous writers of The Elements of Style. Again, a book that has sold in the millions. I believe it's in something like its 11th edition. It's in a gold leaf edition. It's been made into a Broadway musical. This book is hugely influential. My first history class at Tulane, where I was an undergraduate, my history teacher assigned it as a required text to read alongside all of the history books, and he corrected papers based on the rules of Strunk and White. And Strunk and White gave us such rules as, however, cannot begin a sentence like, it was raining all day, however, we managed to play tennis. According to Strunk and White, that is an error. And if you put that in one of my history professor's papers, you get it circled out and you have to move the however somewhere else. They said that hopefully can't be used as what we call a sentential adverb, an adverb applying to the content of the whole sentence, like, it's been raining, but hopefully we'll be able to play tennis later. Strunk and White believe that hopefully can only be what's called a manner adverb, which means that I sat hopefully waiting for my wife to arrive. That it can apply to the verb and the subject of the sentence, but it can't apply to the speaker's attitude towards the whole sentence. There's another rule about which and that probably is a little complicated to go into, but I'm happy to explain it if anybody's curious about it. These have been hugely influential rules, so that there are still scads of people who out there who think that you can't say hopefully we'll be able to go out later. Now, I bet everybody in this room has said, hopefully we'll be able to go out later, at some point on a rainy day, has used hopefully in this way. So the bigger question is, who gets to write these rules and on what basis are they writing them? There's a couple of potential bases. One is logic. They sort of argue from a mathematical point of view almost, which is that, for example, a double negative equals a positive. Loth said that if you say, I haven't got no money, that means you do have some money. That's kind of a mathematical application of logic. Sometimes grammar book writers have reached to the classical languages. At the time these people were writing, especially in the 16 and 1700s, English was still considered a vernacular, and the only languages worthy of respect were Greek and Latin. So they often took rules from Greek and Latin. Because Greek and Latin infinitives are single words, they can't be split, and so people took that from those classical languages and applied it to English, in which an infinitive consists of two separate words, to and go, or whatever the verb is. And they said this cannot be split. It's an atomic unit, just like the Greek infinitive or the Latin infinitive. And in some cases, as with Strunk and White, I think there's just a purely personal hunch. They don't like the way people say hopefully. They construe a post hoc rationale that adverbs have to apply only to the subject and the manner of doing the verb, and that they can't apply to whole sentences. But we have a score of adverbs that are used exactly this way. Frankly, he's a liar. Now, that should be an impossible sentence because he can't be a frank liar. He can only be a dishonest liar, right? Or seriously, he's a doofus. You can't say seriously he's a doofus because he can't seriously be a doofus, right? Except that English allows this. We've been doing this for centuries. These words, hopefully, seriously, frankly, have been used to express the speaker's attitude towards the entire sentence forever. We can look at old history, we can look at old literature, we can look at documents and derive the rules from what people actually do rather than sitting in a study and kind of using our hunches or some kind of faux mathematical logic in order to get us there. So, in the modern age, what we have had is a fight back, a bit of a counter tendency, which is modern linguistics. What linguists, people who have a chair in linguistics at a university, do is they examine the actual language that actual people actually use in the world. And using their observation, whether of written language or of spoken language, they try to describe accurately what people actually do. And so they're responsible for our insights that people have been splitting infinitives since the 14th century. There's a split infinitive in the epic poem Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. There's a split infinitive in Shakespeare. There are split infinitives in the King James Bible and all the way through the history of English. Early scholars in linguistics mostly used written texts, and they looked at the history and they found out that these rules were based on sand, that even our finest writers in our finest contexts broke these so-called rules. So linguistics, we say, is descriptive. It tells us what language looks like, what it really is, what people are actually doing. And that Stickler tradition that I talked about earlier is prescriptive. It tells people what they should do, what they ought to be doing with their language. And often, because these rules will collide, there's been a long and oftentimes bitter conflict between the two schools of thought. Should we write the rules based on what people do? Or should we write them based on the instincts and the scholarship of a Loth or a Strunk or a White or a Jonathan Swift? And so the different schools of linguistics do different things with this. They take different approaches to it. Psycholinguists, for example, might sit and watch somebody read a text with a so-called grammar error, and they can actually track their eyeballs and see if they hang up on an error and see if it's actually difficult to process. If you find an error in a text, your eyeballs will slow down for a moment before you go on. Whereas if the sentence reads naturally to you, you'll scan right through it. So psycholinguistics gives us an actual insight into, are these so-called broken rules really hampering our understanding, or are they perfectly well understood? Syntax is the sort of the most theoretical discipline. It's people like Noam Chomsky sitting around coming up with example sentences and trying to write the rules of a grammar of English that would produce all of the perfectly formed sentences of English, but none of the ill-formed sentences of English. And so that's a very different tendency. But it's the most theoretical branch of linguistics, but it's the one that it really does the most, where the rubber hits the road on grammar. Comparative linguistics is, of course, looking at all the languages of the world. If we say that an infinitive is an atomic unit that can't be split, then this is an easy question. Is it possible to split infinitives in other languages? There are 6,000 languages in the world. So comparative linguists can look at other languages and find out that, of course, there are languages that break this unit up with an adverb or some other bit going in between, you know, the to equivalent and the verb. They can see other languages, of course, ending sentences and prepositions and say, why is this a logical rule if so many well-established languages do it? And finally, and this is probably the most relevant to my work, is sociolinguistics. The questions of class, race, men and women, how they use language differently, nationality, situation, how do people's languages vary based on where they are and what the situation is and what their purposes are. Sarah mentioned, you know, being trained out of her southern accent. And so many of us take our normal way of speaking and we kind of button it up for a formal setting like a prepared speech or a news broadcast. We might try to minimize our accent out of shame. And sociolinguistics is the branch of linguistics that looks at why people do this. What's going on under the hood there in society? Now, why do people get so worked up about the language going down the tubes? I mean, it seems like most of the time we can understand each other pretty well, even when, you know, Sarah's friends in Texas or my friends down in Georgia were using a very southern form of English. We understand each other perfectly well, and yet there's a lot of anxiety that if the language decays, then our thought itself will decay with it. That language, in a way, sits on top of thought and governs what we think and what we're even able to think. Many of you will know the book 1984 by George Orwell, in which there's an appendix in which he describes the principles of the totalitarian language newspeak. The totalitarian society in the book tries to reform the language, strip it of all the words that could be used for subversive or anti-regime thinking, and make it so that only pro-regime thoughts can be expressed. The idea behind Orwell's newspeak was the idea that if you don't have the word freedom in your vocabulary, that it's impossible to think about the concept of freedom. And this idea is very widespread. In fact, in the 1920s, a scholar named Benjamin Lee Whorf here in New York City wrote a famous grammar of the Hopi language, in which he said that Hopi of the southwestern Indians of the United States does not have the English and Western languages' standard words for time, periods of time like day and week and month, and words like later and earlier. And so Whorf gave us the idea that if you do not have the time words in your language, that you will think about time fundamentally differently. And that the Hopi simply didn't conceive of time in a straight line moving forward with the past back there and the future over there in the way that we do. Rather, they have a sort of circular, holistic concept of time. And of course, this is a very romantic notion, the idea that an exotic people with an exotic language had a completely different way of thinking. They don't even have tomorrow or next week. What else do they not have? How powerful is language in our mind? We have the famous idea that Eskimos have dozens or hundreds, and the word varies every time the story is told, of words for snow, and so they must be able to perceive, you know, the difference between this kind of snow and that kind of snow, slushy snow, hard snow, new snow, wet snow, and that they have some special kind of perception of snow because of their language, not because they're Eskimos, not because they live there, but that their language gives them this power. We hear stories in colonial era when the British and the French were colonizing the world of the so-called primitive babbling natives who spoke a language so stripped down of all the niceties of a real language that they couldn't possibly express any higher thought. And in our modern stereotypes, even when we look at the fancy pants languages, the Berlitz languages, as they're sometimes called, the Germans and the French of the world, we think that the structure of a language gives us a clue into the thinking of the people who speak it. You'll often hear people say that the Germans are very logical because German is a logical language. Or you hear that the French are romantic because the French language is a romantic language. I put all of these notions here in the category of either 100% or very largely myth. It turns out that the language you speak can influence your thinking, sometimes, in certain circumstances, but it does not govern how you think. And this doesn't really pass the smell test if you think about it. If you think Orwell was right and that with no word for freedom, you can't think the thought of freedom, then it should be impossible to come up with a new word because the language we already have governs our ability to think. And yet, of course, we're coining new words all the time. I remember in the 1980s there was a show called Not Necessarily the News on cable TV. I don't know if anybody else remembers it. They had a feature called Sniglets, and Sniglets were words that aren't in the dictionary but should be. And so I always remember the one Diagonerd. Diagonerd was somebody who parked diagonally across two parking spaces, thus taking up one more than they needed to, and that was somebody we should look down on. Well, if we didn't have that word, we shouldn't be able to coin it in theory. So the idea that language strongly governs your thinking is the source of a lot of our anxiety. If the language falls to pieces, then our very thinking will fall to pieces. It's a source of our anxiety in this context. Now, fortunately, our research techniques have gotten a lot better, and modern psycholinguistics has actually come up with ways in which the language you speak might influence how you think. There are a couple of research studies I can touch on just briefly. The Russian language, for example, has two words for blue. It doesn't have a single blue. It only has dark blue and light blue. The words are golubой and sini. And there is no word for some middle blue. So everything has to be routed one way or the other. If I see Sarah's shirt there, I would refer to it as sini. It's a darker blue, right? And if you look at Russians and give them two color swatches and say, are they alike or similar, Russians are faster at that test if the two blues straddle the invisible mental line between golubой and sini, because they have an idea that those are two different colors, like our red and yellow. But if they're both golubой or they're both sini, the Russian will take a couple more milliseconds to press a button and identify whether those two colors are alike or different. It's the linguistic thing that makes all of the difference in this. The two color swatches will be the exact same distance apart in hue, but only if they straddle that golubой-sini line will they take a little longer. So we know that in the Russian's mind, it does exert an influence. Another great study, if any of you know languages like Spanish or French or German, you'll know that most European languages have grammatical gender, so you have to learn that a key is feminine in Spanish, la llave, and it's masculine in German, der Schlüssel. So in asking people to describe a key, if you ask Germans, what human-like characteristics would you ascribe to a key? Germans will say a key is strong, it's sturdy, it's hard. And a Spaniard will tend to say it's beautiful, it's golden, it's intricate. So they'll assign stereotypically masculine or feminine words based on the same idea, only because their language has a grammatical gender, der Schlüssel, the masculine German key, and la llave, the feminine Spanish key. We see little subtle bits of influence here. One study that got a lot of attention was that Asians, when taking a test in their language, when answering certain questions about their social attitudes towards community and family, are more community and family-minded when they're speaking their own language, Chinese or Japanese, than they are when given the exact same questions in English. And so the hypothesis is that somehow the Japanese or Chinese language is steering their thinking towards these community-minded aspects, that family is more important than the individual and the team is more important than the members. But how robust are these effects really? It turns out that you can steer people's responses to kind of free-ranging quizzes in a psychology laboratory at a university with all kinds of things. If you paint the walls red, people will express more sort of heated emotions. If you give people a short reading that has community themes in it, then give them that test, the influence of that short reading about community will affect their thinking just as much as whether you're testing them in Chinese or English. So these are effects. They have been found by psycholinguistics, but they're really quite fragile. They can disappear, they're ephemeral, and the effect sizes are quite small. So it's true that your language can affect your thinking, but it does not govern. It does not sit on top of. It does not dictate your thinking. And that's very important to understand because most people have it the other way around. They feel like if the language goes to pot, then our very ability to think of difficult things will go to pot. And so we have a desire to manage the language, to commission grammar book writers to sit down and write along grammar saying, this is how the language must work and this is how it must not. We buy dictionaries, we pay dictionary writers, lexicographers, to say these are the legit words, these are not. And we want the language to be sort of kept in good shape. People's metaphors for this language, for this kind of thing, are like an evolutionary metaphor. Our language has been improving since time immemorial, since the Angles and Saxons and Jutes came over from Denmark and Germany and conquered England, to 1955 when the language was perfect, and that's the guy standing on the right there. And since then, it's been terminal decline, and we don't want to devolve. The language has been evolving, and now it's in danger of devolving. That's one way people often express this. Or that language is a purebred thing, that it should be like this golden retriever down on the left without foreign or outside elements. This isn't so much a problem in English. We tend to happily take words from other languages. But the French, for example, are very famous for resisting the importation of French words into English. This idea of purity is very important to many speakers of many languages, just like that purebred dog. Or like gold, that language should be refined. It should be a shiny, beautiful, valuable thing refined out of the rubbish, the ore that comes out of the mine. And then anything mixed is therefore, by definition, less valuable. Or that it's like a garden. It needs to be elaborately cultivated. The weeds need to be pulled out before they take over. And that the ideal language looks like my French garden up here on the top right. So people have a strong desire to keep the language healthy, whatever it takes, whether it's setting up an academy or at least correcting people in a business meeting. I think you just split an infinitive there, Bob. Well, the fact is that the way we got our language, when that applies to every language in the world, the language that I'm speaking right now, the English language, is contingent and random in so many ways. The language I speak just happens to be a descendant of just one of the many dialects of Old English that were spoken in Great Britain 1,000 years ago. At one point in history, the seat of the English kingdom was down in the West Saxon territory, down in that peninsula on the bottom left. But it so happened that Alfred the Great moved his seat of power to Winchester, just outside of London. And so we have now a political center of power in that Mercian dialect area. And we also set up the two great first English-speaking universities in the world, Oxford and Cambridge, which make up the other two points on my triangle here, Oxford on the left, Cambridge on the right. And so the three centers of really English-speaking authority were right there in the heart of the Mercian dialect area. And so what does that mean? It means that we happen to have this hymn in two of the dialects of English that existed at that time. You can see that in a lot of cases, they're quite different. Look at this word here, or look at Swa versus Sioux, or Vera versus Werk. We can see that had the seat of power been in a different spot in England, we'd be speaking a very different language today. This was just random chance, the move of the capital from one place to another, the fact that the universities happened to be set up in Oxford and not Bristol. That determines the language that I'm speaking right now. Historical accident. The dialect that we ended up with is not better or worse, it's just different. Now, I mentioned that this anxiety about English and that it has to be kept pure, that it's going the wrong way, we must resist corruptions and neologisms. I've mentioned this tradition in English, but it applies to almost every language in the world, and particularly to all of the languages of the world that are written on a regular basis and that are the national language of a country with a capital and a flag and an army and a navy. In fact, there was one great Yiddish linguist named Max Weinreich who said that ein Sprach ist ein Dialekt mit einer Armee und einem Flott. If those of you who speak Yiddish, he said a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. the real language, the ones we celebrate, the ones we think are worthy of writing down, are the ones that have their own country. And everything else is patois, vernacular, dialect, babbling, primitive, or something else. If you get a capital in a country, your language is legit. And if you don't, you won't. You are patois, something not worthy of respect. And this attitude that the language of the country is coextensive with the society and the people and the territory and the culture and the history is probably associated with this country right here more than any other. When we think about language purism, when we think about resisting foreign elements, when we think about language nationalism, we always think of France. We think of the territory of the French language extending exactly where that sort of camo green is, stopping at the borders, maybe goes into Switzerland and Belgium and Luxembourg a bit, but we think of France and French as coextensive. Well, that's not the way it is. That's not the way it ever was. At the time of the French Revolution, there was a clergyman named Abbé Grégoire who took a census, a linguistic census of France, and found that in the territories of France, 3 million people spoke standard French as their first language. 3 million more spoke it as a second language, and 25 million people in the territory of France spoke another language or another dialect. And you can look at this map. This is the real France. This is the real linguistic territory of France, or the hexagon, as the French like to call it, the hexagon. You can see that over in the west, there's a Celtic language, Breton. You can see that down in the southwest is the Basque language, in the southeast is the Catalan language. You can see these two different shades of purple in the middle. In the north, we have the so-called Languedoc, which is the languages that used we for yes. And in the south, the so-called Languedoc, the languages that use the word oc for yes. They're Romance languages related to each other, but very distinct, very different. In the south, we have so-called Provençal and Occitan. These are not dialects of French, but languages that a Parisian French speaker cannot understand. We see up in the north the Flemish language and Alsatian over in the east. So this is the real territory. And if you see in those small texts, if you can read those little titles, you can see that each of these languages has sub-dialects. So each of them is further broken down. So that idea of France and French being almost perfect overlays is not the historical fact. It is the process of a conscious nation-building exercise. What do I mean by that? I mean that when the French revolutionaries took over France, one of their explicit goals was to make everybody in that hexagon speak the exact same way. That the languages of Basque and Catalan and Breton represented backwardness or autocracy or religious superstition, and they wanted to do away with it. And so in the following 200 years, the French government out of Paris did everything it could to suppress and even destroy those languages, to make sure that every citizen of the French Republic, and they put it in a positive way, had access to the civilization and the culture of France. And that to know French was to know this culture, and to hold on to Basque or Catalan was to hold on to the past, to superstition, to all these awful things. And so they stigmatized people. They would hang a token around your neck of shame in the Breton area there in western France if you were caught speaking Breton in your school. I spoke to a Breton man in Brittany who went through this in his own school. You could only take the token of shame off when you caught another student speaking Breton, and then you could put it on that student. So these young people were taught to associate their own language, their first language, their parents' language, and their grandparents' language with shame, all in the service of this so-called mission civilisatrice of French culture, the civilizing mission of France, that to be civilized was to speak proper French, to hold on to Breton or Basque was to be stuck in the past. It was a positive aim, but the goals were, the means used were often coercive, even brutal. So today, Breton is barely alive. Catalan is doing relatively well in the south. There are long stories about this in the book. Basque is hanging on in the southwest. But many of these dialects, Provençal, Occitan, and the like, are now defunct. They're either dead or they're dying. And I think this is a tragedy. This is the real language of real people, of a culture and a history every bit as rich as the French. Now, it's true, of course, that the French language has a great literature going back hundreds of years. It has the Racines and the Molières. And some, I can't remember the name of the writer, who said, show me the Basque Molière, show me the Basque Racine. Well, the answer to that is you can't let a Basque Molière Racine come on the scene when the state is forbidding your language or when it so scorns that language that any writer who wants to be read by a wider audience must write in French. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you argue that only standard French is worthy of the name of civilization, then you shame those languages into those corners that you see here on that map. So there's nothing superior about French to Provençal or Occitan or Basque or Catalan, only the conscious process by which France and French were made coextensive. And the same process can be seen in Spain. It can be seen in England, which chased Welsh and Manx and Cornish and Scottish, Scots Gaelic, Irish languages to the fringes of existence. Some of those languages are dead. Cornish is gone, buried. Scots Gaelic is barely alive. Welsh is stabilized. The Irish Gaelic languages are stabilized. Scots Gaelic is barely going. But this is the process of state building that really gave us our modern Berlitz languages, but at a cost, at a real cost. Coming back to English, I just come back to the point that I started with, which is this is a diverse language, that every language, and English is one of the biggest in the world, every language is characterized by diversity, that its speakers speak different ways at different times, and if a language is big enough, it will definitely have groups that prefer to speak their language their way. Sarah's friends down in Texas, my family down in Georgia, my other family up in Wisconsin. We have so many varieties that I would be devastated to lose if we should shame the diversity out of English. Some of you will recognize this first line up there, the best laid schemes of mice and men gang after glee, Elias not but grief and pain for promised joy. The famous lines from To a Mouse by Robert Burns, a great Scots poet who wrote in the Scots dialect and gave Scotland so much pride in its traditional Scottish variety of English. That second one, what's the use you learning to do right when it's troublesome to do right and ain't no trouble to do wrong and the wages are just the same? Some of you might recognize that from Huckleberry Finn. Would we rather have Mark Twain write that in the English of Oxford or New York City? I wouldn't. And this last one, favorite quote of mine, I done wrestle with an alligator, I done tussle with a whale, I done handcuff lightning and throw thunder in jail. Anybody recognize that one? Muhammad Ali. He's talking to the press before his fight with George Foreman. Would you rather, Muhammad Ali said, I've wrestled with an alligator, I've wrestled with a whale, I've handcuffed lightning and thrown thunder in jail. Would I have that same punch? No, it would not. So diversity is a fact. This is just one linguist map of the language diversity, the dialect diversity of the United States. And all of these lines represent some boundary where on one side of the line is one single feature or a bundle of features, and on the other side is another bundle. So we see the South is kind of a mostly a grayish color there, but there's a bit of a green there in the highland part of the South. On either side of the line is a distinction about how the vowel I is pronounced in certain words. On the white side of the line, we'd say right. And on the green side of the line, we'd say right. So you see right with a glide and then rat without a glide. That's highland Southern versus lowland Southern. We can see that even in the South, there's this great fascinating diversity in how people speak. And you can see even Canada is divided, and that would go on and on for any language in the world. So I find this diversity totally fascinating. If I didn't, I wouldn't just go chasing these stories around the world, asking everybody I know, interviewing them about something else, and then I'll say, where are you from, and why did you use that word? Because it's just simply fascinating to me. And it's wonderful to hear people use the language differently. It's interesting, intellectually, to watch someone who's just been speaking of heavily black American English or heavy Southern American English, get up in front of a camera or a podium and suddenly switch perfectly into a standard English, no accent, standard grammar, and so forth. People can be bi-dialectal. They often are. People like me can go down to Thanksgiving in Georgia and the Southern accent creeps out a bit and the y'all and the ain't creeps out a bit, and then it goes back away when I come back up to New York. But that diversity is something that every one of us should cherish. To stomp it out of the language in the name of we must have one English for everyone, for all occasions, is not just not historically justified. I've shown you all these rules that are bogus and you should forget about. But I think it would be a loss to our culture. It'd be a loss of some bit of who we are. And so I finish with a plea for diversity, for tolerance, for multilingualism. I obviously love learning foreign languages. And the more that people have in their head that it's a good thing to be able to speak in more than one way, whether you have two dialects or two languages, that this is a richness, not a problem. Thank you very much. So we have some time, and I would be happy to take any questions you have. Yeah.
I
I want to go ahead and confess. I have peeves too. Every one of us in this room, if you come to a talk on language, you probably have a few things that drive you crazy. Mine is literally. I hate when people say literally, figuratively. Like, he was literally holding a gun to my head, and so I had to say yes. Well, unless he literally had a gun to your head, no, he wasn't. And literally is so good when you can use it correctly. If somebody was holding a gun to your head, that gives that word a lot more punch, right? I assume when you say people are not using me properly, they don't use it in between you and me. People say between you and I instead. What are they doing? That's interesting. That's a phenomenon that we call hypercorrection, which is that people, like I started the story with my grandfather. Me and Hank are going to the store. Who's going to the store? Hank and I are going to the store. What does a six-year-old learn from that? He can maybe figure out, okay, in subject position it's I and in object position it's me, but that's pretty sophisticated. So what a lot of people learn was a half version of the rule, which is it's always I if you add a second subject. It's always Hank and I, Hank and I, Hank and I. The Hank and me is always wrong. Well, Hank and me is not always wrong. If I say he gave that present to Hank and me, it's correct. But if I say Hank and I gave the present, then I is correct. So it's called hypercorrection. People learning a part of the rule and overextending it to places it doesn't belong. So a lot of language pundits who are otherwise sort of descriptivists like me often will have a chuckle at hypercorrection because it's people trying too hard. They're thinking they're being the stickler. They think they're applying the rule right, and they're applying it wrong. So it's a double sin of both being a bit of a snob and getting the rule wrong to boot. So don't be that person. If you're going to insist on the rule, if you're going to correct somebody else, and by all means, correct them on a sound basis.
Yeah.
There's a whole right. There's a lot of writing on this. It's a fascinating topic. It's one that I don't have enough time for to get into in detail today, but I have a whole presentation I do on this subject, which is, I think, most importantly, it's the issue of metaphorical framing. A writer, a scholar of language, George Lakoff at Berkeley University in California, writes about, he wrote a book called Metaphors We Live By. He told a great story about how his editor tried to make him change the title to Metaphors By Which We Live. And he said... He said, by God, I'm a professor of linguistics, and I am not changing my title. And he was right to stand by his position there. But what Lakoff writes about is the way issues are framed metaphorically. And I'll give you one example that I know of. A study where people were given a series of crime statistics in a fictional town. And in the rest of the story was identical with all of the numbers, but the first line differed. In the first line, it said, crime is a beast ravaging the city of Addison. And the second group got a different paragraph, which is crime is a virus ravaging the city. Crime is a virus ravaging the city of Addison. Now, after reading the paragraph in the same exact statistics, the two experimental groups were asked, what would you prescribe as a solution to crime in the city of Addison? Well, lo and behold, the people who got the beast metaphor were by 17 percentage points more likely to recommend prison, police, law and order, a hard approach. People who got the virus metaphor were likely to recommend education, social spending, those other approaches. So crime is neither a beast nor a virus. In both cases, we're taking an abstract thing, a beast or a virus, we can get our hands on. In exchange, we're putting it in place of an abstract thing, a phenomenon socially. And every time something is metaphorized in this way, it can steer your thinking. So again, I talked about language not dominating your thinking, not perfectly channeling it, but it can influence. And so we see examples like that, and a good politician will do exactly that. You know, should we raise taxes in the next 4 years? That's a big question you're all going to have to decide on November 7th. You'll always hear the Democrats refer to them as revenues. A tax is a burden, right? A tax is something heavy on you. We use the word tax metaphorically all the time. Talk about something that's, it was very taxing, that commute. Whereas revenues are something good. It's money coming in. A company that's successful has revenues, right? I remember that under George Bush, we eliminated a thing called what Republicans called the death tax, and what Democrats called the estate tax. Now, it's the exact same thing, whatever you call it, but a death tax, God, can you imagine anything more grim than, you know, granny's on her last leg, she's scratching out her will in the deathbed, family surrounding her, and as soon as she breathes her last breath, the IRS man shows up in his gray suit and says, that'll be 35% of granny's estate. It's horrible to imagine. But if I say estate to you, now what do you think of? You think of land, you think of a big, nice house, you think of a bunch of bottles of Bordeaux in the basement, you think of grandfather clocks. And so when that guy kicks the bucket, you think, well, what could be the harm in taking a little bit of that from his spoiled kids and giving it to, you know, a Head Start or a preschool? So it's the exact same thing. The metaphorical frame can be really, really critical, and it can be used well, very effectively.
I want to appear. Has age always been a factor in changing language? I mean, for example, I can just prefer
right. Awesome age, yeah. Right. Like and awesome. I've written articles on both like and awesome and dude, by the way. I find slang fascinating. You might not be surprised. The young are innovators. They're innovators in everything. If you're under 25, you're more likely to get your news from your iPhone or from a blog. And if you're older than 75, you're more likely to read a newspaper. And so young people are not in the same habits. And so they are typically a big part of the engine of language change. Absolutely. And it drives every older generation crazy. When I'm 75, I'll be saying, God, I can't stand the kids saying this. But what you need to know down to your bones is that when they're 75, they'll be saying that about their grandkids. And when Swift was 75, he was saying it about the kids in his age. So it's perpetual. Language never devolves. It never falls to pieces. It's always changing. Change is just a constant in language. But there's never been a language that devolved from proper speech to babbling. It's just not something that language does, because if one word passes out of the language, if it's important enough, another word will fill its space. It's a system where all the parts need to be in place and need to be working. So it's a changing system. It's a fluid system. But it's a complete system. And there's not a language that can't really handle all of the most important functions of a language. That's a great question. English is no longer the property of the British or the English, which is to their chagrin. They can't stand the American influence on the English language often. And it's no longer the exclusive property of the United States either. It's now a world language in which people are doing business all over, Indians, Filipinos, and everyone. So it's a little hard to say. I don't like to make clear predictions here, only that we'll see new varieties emerge. There's a stable variety of dialect of language called Singapore English. It has certain grammatical features that are distinct to Singapore. It has certain words that come from Chinese and Malay and other languages. So we'll see those dialects emerge. But we also see a sort of stripped-down English that is used for wider communication. When a Brazilian businessman is in France trying to sell aircraft to a French defense contractor, he'll speak English. And chances are they'll both avoid metaphor and slang and the latest jargon and really stick to a very crisp English that's kind of stripped of a lot of the ambiguity just for the purposes of transactions. So we can see both diversity and unity. It doesn't have to be one or the other. We're seeing a uniform English emerge for the world. We're also seeing these new varieties. And I think that's great. I think it's better that we can have both communication and diversity. It doesn't have to be one or the other, and that's what I push back on in the book. I put it in the back. I don't know specifically about the Revolutionary War soldiers, but I can tell you that certain features of American English today were standard English features 250 years ago, and it is British English that has changed, and it's American English that held on to the old form. One example is the A vowel in words like path and bath. Now Brits will say bath, but the bath pronunciation was common throughout southern England back in that time. Second, one of the most notable features of English, British English in the South, is the pronunciation of R or the non-pronunciation. So we say park and car. Well, in fact, those dialects in the South said park and car and pronounced the R there. They lost it. That was a sound change. So in those senses, America is more conservative. The past participle gotten, for I have gotten this or that, is an old form with 500 years old. It disappeared in English, and now they only say I have got. So that Brits process gotten as an Americanism is something we, newfangled English speakers ginned up. But in fact, it's an old form we kept, they got rid of. And so it's a fascinating subject, because if you hear Brits complaining about Americanisms, very often they're complaining about centuries-old features of the most standard English there is. And I should say, we're now at 7:30-ish, so anybody who needs to leave will not offend me, but I am very happy to take a few more questions as well. Okay?
The map of
two ideas I'd love your feedback on. One is that I think you mentioned that Catalan and Basque languages are, you know, on a resurgence, or, but there's also separatist movements mm-hmm. in that area. And I'm just curious, you know, putting that together with your last remark about the how wonderful diversity is, and I couldn't disagree with you, but on the other hand, sometimes it leads to identity politics
right.
and separatism. And right. then the other thought was that the Chinese are, the People's Republic of China, rather, has mm-hmm. done on a major, huge level, the type of effort to consolidate.
Yeah, extending Mandarin at the expense of Cantonese and Shanghainese.
And
so,
the
yep.
same kind of map with the
yep.
minorities and
yep.
borders.
Absolutely. So, again, we come back to my political science point, which is that languages with a state or a political unit on their side have a lot better long-term fighting shot. The reason Basque and Catalan are doing well is not just because there are separatist movements now, but they also have independent regions in Spain. Across the border, there is an independent Basque country region, and there's an independent Catalonia, semi-independent, I should say, in the Spanish country. So, because they can formulate their own education policy in the local capitals, they can teach kids Basque and Catalan. So it's Bretagne, for example, back on that map, if you look, Bretagne does not have the ability to do that. They don't set local education policy in Nantes there, in Brittany. They set it in Paris for the whole country. So that keeps those languages alive. Now, what about the downside? What if we give every language in the world a state, or what if we say everybody has the right to speak their own language? What if these countries fall apart? It's something of a slippery slope argument. You know, if we recognize language one, do we have to recognize two and three all the way down to tiny languages? And there's not an easy answer. There are clearly languages that have a long history, a cohesive culture. People are very committed to them and want education, written material, news broadcasts, and so forth in that language. And when that group is big enough, I think we should seriously try to accommodate them. When it's a small language, a tiny language, the question of whether to let that group assimilate to the larger language or to try to keep them holding on to a small language that may hold them back economically, may keep them from integrating into the larger economy, is a painful one. Because as a linguist, you might like to keep the language, that beautiful bit of diversity. As an economist, you might say, these people can't move to the city and get a job. China is in a furious effort to extend Mandarin to all the corners of China at the expense of Tibetan and Nepalese. The other varieties of Chinese, so Shanghaiese and Fujian and Wu and all of the other dialects of Chinese. And when I say dialects, by the way, you should know that a Cantonese speaker and a Mandarin speaker cannot have a conversation. They can only do so if the Cantonese speaker knows Mandarin. Very unlikely the Mandarin speaker will know Cantonese. But they are as different from one another as Spanish is from French, right? So these are really different languages in China, which is hugely diverse linguistically. And China is doing today exactly what the French were doing 100, 200 years ago. And it may build the Chinese state to the benefit of the Chinese economy. It's also at a loss of diversity. And that's a painful trade-off that there's not a glib answer to, unfortunately.
Right. The pastors and how different he sounded from the way we hear him on TV now. And
yep.
Sure.
Well, I talked a little bit before about how when I go down to Thanksgiving in Georgia, my Southern accent will come out a bit of out of the woodwork. And we do see that with Obama in front of a black audience. We'll also see it when Bill Clinton or some other politician speak to a black audience. Bill Clinton is a master chameleon. He really knows his audience. He knows how to connect and how to communicate. We can also see it in an ugly form where someone who's not very good at it tries to do it. And Hillary Clinton, for example, doesn't have that native talent. She gets kind of country when she goes to Kentucky, and it doesn't really work out well for them. It's very common for people to do that, to try to connect, and I think it's a good thing at the general level, which is that we try to accommodate each other linguistically. And so when two people are speaking, each will kind of approach each other's language. Now, in the case of Black English, there's a lot to be said on the subject. There's a lot in the book. The non-standard dialect speakers of English, black English speakers, Southern English speakers, Scots English speakers, they all need to learn standard English to succeed in the English-speaking world. The economy, the best jobs, require it. So I'm very adamant that there is a thing called standard English and that it's particularly incumbent on minorities need it even more than those of us who were lucky enough to be born with it. And that doesn't have to be at the cost of diversity, because you see bi-dialectal speakers. You see people who are comfortably able to sort of talk in black English at home with their friends and family, and they walk into the office and change clothes just like they might change their suit, change dialects, and function very well in standard English. So it doesn't have to be a trade-off. So I encourage people to kind of revel in their local diversity and also to learn standard English, which is the key to everything they're going to need later on.
Yeah, I think the sad thing is Bill Clinton can speak more of his home language just to whichever audience and TV. Obama really can't.
That's true. Bill Clinton, George Bush can let their Southern English, can let their Southern accent at least be clear when they speak. It's not something. Now, Obama's a special case because he grew up with a white family. And so the African American dialect is not his home dialect. He's a good linguist. He speaks Indonesian, by the way, passably at least. And so has moved from Hawaii to Indonesia to New York between an African father and a white mother. And so as someone who I think does that relatively effectively, changes his tone based on what he does. But you're right, he can't address a national audience in a black inflected English. He would get, I mean, it's unthinkable, but if he did it, I can only imagine what people would say.
Did you learn all your languages?
Sorry, go ahead. And then,
did you learn all your languages in school or some self-taught?
A couple of self-taught. I taught myself Danish, having met my wife, who's from Denmark. And so I basically have one skinny book that I use, and I've been speaking with her ever since I met her. Taught myself Italian pretty quickly. But mostly, I've had some kind of instruction. Took Arabic at NYU, Russian, Portuguese, French, German in college, Spanish in high school. So I've had help. But I love self-teaching. I will get books and CDs and iPhone apps and surround myself with it to do it because I just think it's fun. And I think it's really possible.
Yeah. Do you speak Arabic?
I do, yeah.
I've started.
I've about three or four surahs in. The Quran's Arabic is pretty old-fashioned, so it's a little hard going. It's like reading the King James Bible if you're a second language speaker of English. But it's slow going. But yeah, very much so. Yeah. Right.
And it's really apparent. I know you touched on that with the other sections in France, but how is it comparable? It's so different.
Well, it's very common that the accent and the dialect of the capital are the prestigious ones, and so you know, you might talk about a Manchester accent or a Birmingham accent in London. People think the Birmingham type sounds stupid. They'll say it in unguarded moments. So the same would apply to a Belgian accent in Paris. Most of the sort of dumb jokes, you know, we have Polak jokes in English. The French make dumb jokes about the Belgians. They're sort of the standard butt of stupid people jokes. So that is common, yes. I speak French well, but I don't speak it exactly like a Parisian. So when I speak French with people, they often look at me and say, "Are you Belgian?" Not because they think I'm stupid. Hopefully not because they think I'm stupid, but because there's something slightly they can't quite place about the way I'm speaking. So they guess I grew up with French, but maybe it's not my first language. I might be from the northern part of Belgium. But yeah, that level of prejudice is pretty common. I do not. I'm actually learning. I'm doing a review about the Rosetta Stone software, which I'm bore you about another day. But I'm testing it in Mandarin, so I'm learning a lot right now. I've studied the Chinese language, studied about it, so I've read a lot of books and such about how the language works. But I don't speak it.
What do you dream in?
Oh, I dream in English most of the time. I think that if I've been spending a lot of time speaking Danish when I go and spend 2 weeks with my parents-in-law in Copenhagen, I try to speak only Danish and succeed more or less. And so by the end of 2 weeks, I might start kind of, it's primed and it's running all the time. It warms up. It's like a muscle. I mean, I have a lot of languages I don't speak very often, but when I start speaking German again and I haven't spoken in years, it's rusty to start, but lo and behold, it does warm up. It is weird. A lot of people say that when you first have a dream in a foreign language, you know that you really got it. So I see Sarah standing up. Oh, sure.
Do you have any idea about how or why the G got dropped from all of these words, like working,
right,
and everyone from TV
angles, right, and
pundits,
and right.
Like,
right. Why? There are rules of sound change that predict certain things will happen in the future. Certain kinds of consonants will tend to mutate into other kinds of consonants. The ng sound at the end of working and playing is kind of an unusual one. You pronounce it at the back of your mouth with what's called your velum, and it's a bit nasal, so with a little sound. It's a slightly exotic sound. The working sound, the n sound at the end, is more common. So a lot of times when sounds change, more unusual sounds will resolve to simpler sounds. That's my guess at why it's happened. But here's a fun fact about that. Very fun, in fact, is that 150 years ago, the dropped G, so far, so-called work and playing accent, was the standard high-class way to do it. And it was the ordinary people who say working and playing. And how exactly those switched, I don't know, but the switch is very well documented. You can look it up and read all about it. That in older novels and older plays and such, you'll see it as a mark of class that people drop their G's, and that's the polite thing to do. So sometimes dropping letters is the polite way to go. Today, people drop H's at the beginning of certain words in British English, and that's considered cockney and something we look down on. Sound change is neutral, you know. No language has ever become unintelligible over time, but it often has a social piece. In this case, there was that unusual switch, and we see it going on all the time. I think we're going to take that as the last standard question, and then I'm happy to stick around. I'm going to go and assign books for those of you who'd like a book, and I'll be happy to take more of your questions then. So thank you so much for being so patient and taking so much time.